quarter of a century ago, a movie came on the scene that changed the some of the genre, even in movies, to where now we have very much, or most movies are, action movies. And this was one of the earlier just intense action movies, and it was Raiders of the Lost Ark. And if you recall that movie, if you've seen it, there's not much of a pause to breathe in the entire movie. Only a couple of times that there's a 30-second period when something's not going on. And that movie, obviously by the title, is about the Ark of the Covenant, the historic Ark of Israel that contained the Ten Commandments and Aaron's rod, and the Ark in the movie is an artifact, just an archaeologist searching for this lost historic Ark and then finding it, and yet some of the things that go on with the Ark, as it is portrayed in the movie, that the Ark has this power. And it's demonstrated in the movie as when the Germans gain control over it, and when they open it, just the devastation that occurs. You know, the Ark is viewed as this thing of great power. Well, that's very much the attitude that the Israelites had at times, as we see evidenced in this text this morning. You know, it raises the question, what happens when we really misplace our confidence? You know, we can have a theology, but what happens when our theology gets off slightly? To where we shift and we're no longer actually honoring, worshiping, and trusting the God of the universe, but certain objects that were there for worship, certain representations. You know, if you go back to the account on the very early days of leaving Egypt in the period of the Exodus, Moses has gone up on the mountain and been up there for 40 days, and the congregation comes to a conclusion that Moses has died on the mountain. And there's nothing in the text that suggests that the people are abandoning God. Everything points actually to the fact that they still are looking to the same God, though their distortion, you know, their concepts get distorted, and they decide they need a representation of that God, and thus comes the golden calf. The golden calf becomes an object to worship, but they really weren't seeking to worship another God. And their mindset is, we're going to create this object of worship, but we're really not worshiping another God. But yet, God has already declared, or well, I guess was declaring in the Ten Commandments, that in itself is missing the concept of who God is. And so we come up with various things that in an age in the church and age and within certain traditions where we don't really have a lot of symbolisms, we still have various things that point to God that are appropriate to engage in, but they're really not God, but we could shift our trust to that. Maybe it's shifting your trust, you know, in the sense of that you're in church, that you go to church, that you attend church, that you read the Bible. Things that are good, things that have a place, things that are appropriate discipline. But if we misplace that trust, then we miss something very significant. So let's look through actually three chapters in Samuel this morning. 1 Samuel 4 and 5 and 6. And so look at this misplaced confidence, but in this narrative material that moves through here, it's that there's, it would almost have seemed that the focus is on the Ark, because it's even sometimes called the Ark narratives, because it in the literature is what's in focus as we read the text. But it really isn't the Ark that's in focus. For if we were to say that, we'd be making the same mistake that's been made as we read. It's the God that's behind the Ark. It's the God that is the God of the Ark that is the true one in focus. It begins, in these three, the first chapter that we'll look at, chapter 4, first, Israel places a complete confidence in Yahweh's power, but are defeated. They place complete confidence in the very power of Yahweh, but yet they are defeated in battle. And that doesn't seem possible. How could they have such confidence in God's power and be defeated? It begins in, really our section begins in the middle of verse 1. It starts off in verse 1, "Thus the word of Samuel came to all Israel," which is probably a summary or connection in the transition with the previous chapter and the conclusion of the previous chapter. But in the middle of the verse it says, "Now Israel went out to meet the Philistines." So here we have the setting. The Philistines have come in battle array against Israel, and Israel is in a position to engage in this battle with the Philistines. In verse 2, it continues to this of how they pull up to one another, to engage in this war. And the middle of verse 2 says, "When the battle spread, Israel was defeated before the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the battlefield." 4,000 were killed on the battlefield. If you bring that into modern day, where you can have a vast destruction because of technology and the kinds of weapons we can have, 4,000 people is a lot of people to die in one day. Even today, you think about 4,000 people dying in one day, that's a major conflict. But you go back to a time when there weren't, it wasn't that some giant bomb was going off. It wasn't that missiles were being sent in on a cruise missile to come in and blow up things. This was a totally different type of war, and 4,000 from Israel died. Verse 3 continues, says, "When the people came into the camp, the elders of Israel said," and this is really key. This becomes a key section here, a key question. And we see here with the Israel is that following this defeat, it never occurred to them that Yahweh had been defeated. It's only, why did the powerful Yahweh allow this to happen? Notice the question that the elders of Israel ask in the middle of verse 3. It says, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines?" See, their theology, their whole concept isn't the Philistines beat us. Why has Yahweh defeated us? Because they recognize He is not a God, but He's the God. Why has He defeated us? And so they come up with a solution. And the solution is in the middle of the rest, or the last half of that verse. And it says, "Let us take to ourselves from Shiloh the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, that it may come up among us and deliver us from the power of our enemies." And you notice the shift in the theology. Their question was very astute. A great question. Why has Yahweh defeated us? So they don't say, why has the Philistines defeated us? They see the sovereignty of God. Why has God allowed this to happen? And they come up with their own solution. And their solution is, we're going to go get the Ark of the Covenant. We'll bring the Ark of the Covenant here, for it represents God. And all of a sudden, notice, the Ark of the Covenant will be there. It'll be among us. And it will deliver us. The shift is almost seeing the Ark of the Covenant as this little artifact that we would say now, but at that time, this piece of furniture has power. Not the God that it represents, if you would, not that it was an idol, but in that association would be a better word, not the association that Yahweh But they start to see that. See, you go back in time, and the ark was, out in front. When they crossed certain places, when they went to certain things, the ark was in front. And in that time of the Exodus, it became obvious that Yahweh was God. And not only did Israel respond, but the other nations did. The nations feared because they saw what the God of Israel did to the Egyptians, what the God of Israel did to others that got in the way. And so they bring in the ark. And so in verse 4 it continues and it says, so they went to Shiloh, they get the ark, they bring the ark back. And then we're told that in the last part of verse 4 it says, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the ark of the covenant of God. And so now we have the two wicked priests, the useless men, those that despise the offerings of God, that they are the ones in charge of the Ark of the Covenant. Verse 5 says, and it happened as the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, that all Israel shouted with a great shout, so that the earth resounded. I mean, that they are so excited that there's an intimidation factor that happens here. Back in the 70s, mid-70s, when Grant Taft was the coach at Baylor University, and Baylor, during that time, became a national football power, able to compete with the major schools. And they played, I believe it was Michigan, and they were in Michigan. And one of the things there is that with that kind of a stadium, which almost all major schools, their stadiums are very big and they seat 70, 80, but that stadium seats over 100,000 people. And there weren't many from Waco that were able to get seats, I don't imagine, in that stadium. And when the team comes out and they're on the field and then Michigan enters, and you have approximately 100,000 and maybe there's 8,000 for you and there's 100,000 against you, there's a decided advantage. And the officials were aware that nobody was going on the field, and they came to Baylor's dressing room and knocked on the door and said, Coach, it's time for you to go on the field. And Taft says, no, that's okay. We'll go after Michigan goes out. And Taft refused to go on the field. And Michigan had to enter the game, and after they were on the field, then Baylor came out. And, there's an intimidation factor. And here's this congregation of Israel is cheering. The uproar is so great because now they have confidence renewed. We lost yesterday, but we won't lose today because we have the ark. Verse 7, the Philistines were afraid. See, it worked. The Philistines are afraid. And they said, God has come into the camp. Now, this is their theology, their understanding of gods and who Israel is, who Yahweh is of Israel. God is coming to the camp. Woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us. Who shall deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods who smote the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues in the wilderness. So, their theology isn't the correct theology, but they do understand something from experience. So they see the God of Israel just as gods, but they also know something from their history. Now, this is not their own experience because they're going back many years, but this oral tradition has passed down that the God of Israel defeated Egypt. And they make this association with this jubilee and this ark being there of that he is entered. They're excited. Their God is there, and we're in trouble. Because we've got our gods, but nobody's gods have ever been able to stand up when their God is present. And we might expect at this time that they would just turn and run to go home. But they're left with this quandary that, what are we going to do? We're not as powerful as they are. They're going to win. There's only one solution. And actually, it kind of backfires on Israel at this point. Verse 9, "Take courage and be men, O Philistines, or you will become slaves to the Hebrews, as they have been slaves to you. Therefore, be men and fight." So they do not fight from a position of confidence. They don't fight because they have a renewed sense of, oh, sure, we're going to win this battle. They fight out of desperation because they know Israel has this great advantage that the gods are there. So the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated, and every man fled to his tent, and the slaughter was very great, for there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers. We saw in the first battle 4,000. Now 30,000. 30,000 died. But on top of that, verse 11, "And the ark of God was taken, and the two sons of Eli died." Recall that we saw before that God had come to Samuel and said, actually, he sent a man of, it was said in the text, the man of God came to Samuel and said, "Judgment will come on your house, and your two sons are going to die, and you'll have a confirmation that this is indeed divine judgment because they will both die on the same day." Now, several years later, we see the fulfillment. God had confirmed that through his first prophecy to Samuel, and now that has been fulfilled. And so Israel engaged in this war, and they were defeated. They lost in the military battle, and now they have a greater loss. It's devastating. The second part of this chapter, Israel concludes that Yahweh has been defeated. See, before it was simply, why has the powerful Yahweh allowed us to be defeated? Why has He defeated us? But now it's that Yahweh's been defeated. In this next section, and for the remainder of the chapter, you have the report comes to Israel that this great devastation has occurred, the defeat has been enormous, and that the Ark of the Covenant has been taken. Then the report comes to Eli, who is an aged man. The last time we saw Eli, his eyesight was failing. Now we encounter Eli, and his eyesight has completely failed. And he is, an elderly man, and he hears the news. And he's asking, what's happening? So the guy comes and he says, "Your sons, there's two sons have died. They've been killed in battle. And on top of that, the Ark of the Covenant has been captured." And you notice in the text, in verse 18 of chapter 4, it says, "And it came about when he mentioned the Ark of God that Eli fell off the seat backward beside the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died, for he was very old and heavy." He had judged Israel for 40 years. That it wasn't the news of his sons that overwhelmed him so that he, in a sense, either fainted or just fell over, but it was the news that the ark had been captured. Following this is Eli's daughter-in-law is giving birth. And she gives birth to her son, and she is so devastated that she names him Ichabod and explains in verse 21 and says that she called the boy Ichabod, saying, "The glory has departed from Israel because the ark had been taken, because her son, her husband had been killed, and because her father-in-law had died. That the glory has departed from Israel. The glory has departed from Israel." See, Israel placed their confidence not truly in God, but in God's power. As actually for them, represented in the ark. They asked the right question, why has God allowed this to happen? But they didn't pursue it in the right way. You know, the end of chapter 3 tells us that God has revealed himself to Israel, I mean to Samuel, and that Samuel is his spokesman. And even the beginning of chapter 4 says that, you know, once again, reminds us of that Samuel is God's man. Samuel is the one that will speak for God. Samuel is his prophet. And the elders come to that point. They go, why has this happened? At that moment would have been the time to say, Samuel, what do you think? What does God have to say on this? Should we just back down? Should we go back to battle? You know, better than that, before they went the first time, they should have been asking. But that's not where they're at. The text has already given us that clue that it is a nation that is in trust in worthless people. It's a nation that has no spirituality. That's been set up for us in, you know, by looking at Eli's sons and the judgment that's coming on Eli. And then now we see it in the broad's perspective as they do not pursue God at all, but they pursue his power. A confidence in his power, but no relationship with him. And now the glory has departed. Well, think about the Philistines as we move into chapter 5. The Philistines now, they have quite a different setting. They were confident, if there was a confidence, confident that they were going to be defeated because Israel's gods were there. But they actually went out and had a great victory. And now they have the Ark, this prestigious symbol of power. This, from their perspective, this image of a god. Because they have various images for their gods, and now they have Israel's God, if you would. And so they take the Ark of the Covenant. So we look at chapter 5, we might say that in the second part, the Philistines discover that Yahweh was not defeated. They had assumed that he was defeated because they won. Seemed like a reasonable conclusion, but it was a wrong conclusion. Israel had concluded that the glory is departed. They assume that, but they discovered that Yahweh was not defeated. We see the Yahweh in the court of the gods in the first five verses. It's a great setting. It's just, if you could imagine this, and you have to use a little bit of your imagination, but there's some kind of a courtyard, and in this courtyard is this great image of a god. And he has somewhat of a human characteristics. He has hands and he has feet and he has a head. And you can imagine that he's a very large stone statue. And they bring the Ark of the Covenant in and they set it down. And so here is Dagon, this human-looking god, and here is the Ark. And there must have been some celebration. I mean, the victory that we have. And here is the Ark in somewhat of a position of submission to Dagon. The next morning, they awake. And some giant wind or something has happened, an earthquake, something has happened, and unfortunately, Dagon has fallen down. But the image, if you were to look at it, would be, here's the Ark, and now the stone statue is humbled himself before the Ark. But obviously, that's just a fluke that something happened, and so they stand him back up. The next morning when they wake, something different has happened. Not only has he fallen this time, but his hands broke off. And his head broke off. And now they start to think, maybe something different is going on here. And then in the weeks to follow, and the text is a little hard to follow this point in its exactness because it just tells us that tumors came and then later there's a reference to mice. It doesn't tell us exactly how this happened, but it would appear that there was a plague that came upon the nation, upon these countries of the Philistines. And that this plague, perhaps something like a bubonic plague or something to that effect, came upon him. And it they had tumors and many people are dying. They see this association and they begin to wonder, is there truly an association? Is this because this ark is here? And after the devastation starts to spread, they finally come to the point that we've got to seek a solution. And so perhaps it is this ark. But how do we know for sure? So one way to know for sure is that we will send this ark back to Israel. And when it is out of our country, if all of this devastation stops, we know for sure that it was the ark. But how can we be sure about all this? I mean, if we're going to send it back, we better make a guilt offering. We better do some sacrifice to this God that, you know, for if this is real, I mean, this God's pretty powerful. He's more powerful than our gods. And so they come up with this deal of there apparently are five major lords, five major political powers in the Philistine empire at this time. And so for each one, there's a golden tumor made. Now, this is a little hard to fathom why, this is to be honoring, other than it's a recognizing that God has sent this tumor. And then there are five golden mice. And so that's where we get the idea that surely this was some disease that was spread by mice, and that mice had somewhat like the plagues in Egypt, that it had been through various things, and it just mice had invaded the country. So they had these five golden tumors and five golden mice, and then they go, well, how are we going to be for sure that this is really their God that's doing this? And I say, okay, I know what we'll do. We're going to build this brand new cart because, you know, we have to honor this God, and so it's got to be a new cart. We'll put the ark on it, and then we're going to go get a couple of cows that have baby calves that are still nursing. Cows that have never been hooked up to a cart before. And so you got a couple of things. Cows, they really won't have the association to be able to pull this. They're not been trained to pull the cart yoked together. They won't be able to do that. And their natural inclination will not be to go toward Israel, but to be going back home to find their babies. So they've got a good plan here. And so they get it all hitched up and loaded down and turn the cows loose, and they go straight to Israel. And so the Philistines conclude that Israel's God is indeed God. I've got a few passages here. Chapter 5, look at verse 6. Now the hand of the Lord was heavy. The Ashdodites are the ones that the idea of worshipers here of in this temple area. The hand of the Lord was heavy. Verse 7. When the men of Ashdod saw that it was so, they said, "The ark of God of Israel must not remain with us, for that his hand is severe upon us and on." You gotta love this. He's not only severe on us, but he's severe on Dagon, our God. You know, so our God is getting beat up by this guy. Verse 9, it came about after they had brought it around, the hand of the Lord was against the city with very great confusion. Verse 11, toward the end, it says once again the same thing. The hand of God was very heavy upon them. That they see this as Yahweh's in charge. The sovereignty they see in Yahweh. Israel has moved into a position of idolatry and not commitment. And the Philistines come to recognize this God of Israel, how powerful He truly is. And so they send the ark back. And so in this chapter 6, we see that Yahweh is exalted. He's exalted as they send him back. He's exalted. We see this continuation of hand in verse 3. It says, by sending him back and the guilt offerings, then we shall, the last part, then we shall be healed, and it shall be known to you why his hand is not removed from you. Again in verse 5, and so as they make these tumors and mice for all this, it says at the end of verse 5, perhaps he will ease his hand from you, your gods and your land. So once again, he's showing Yahweh is superior not only to the people, but to their gods. And then in verse 9, as they're going to watch this cart go away, it says, watch, if it goes up by the way of its own territory to Beth Shemesh, then he has done us this great evil. But if not, then we shall know that it was not his hand that struck us, that it just happened by chance. So here they come up with this plan, and they execute the plan, and indeed the milk cows take, the cows that are nursing their babies take the cart to Israel. And so the Philistines conclude, indeed this was a judgment by the God of Israel. And hopefully now he will let up his judgment upon us and his judgment upon our gods. For they clearly see that their gods are inferior to Israel's God. But there's also interesting, as you look through this, we find something at the end of the chapter that as the ark comes back, that it would appear that this town that it comes to, that the people open up the ark and look in, and there are people that die. There's the number in the text is 5,070, which is a little strange to have such a large number, but yet get to a, or 50,070, to get to that specific, 70, it would appear either that it's combining all the numbers that have died in this time period, or that maybe we have a textual error at this point, and it's the 70, which is what the Greek translation has here of the Old Testament, that it was 70, which would make more sense in this setting, that in this town 70 people died. Well, now they are fearful of the ark, and they want the ark taken somewhere else, because we see once again that the Philistines had come to respect the ark, but when the ark comes back to Israel, Israel at that point still didn't have this respect for God. But they learned there. But as we look at it overall, we see that chapter 4 leads up to and concludes with the departure of Yahweh's glory. The glory has departed from Israel. That's that concluding thought. The glory has departed. Chapter 5 demonstrates the superiority of Yahweh. He is superior to the Philistines' gods. Dagon bows down before him. And then all the plagues that occur. Then in chapter 6, expresses the return of Yahweh's glory. Notice in chapter 6 and verse 5, it says, so you shall make likenesses of your tumors and likenesses of your mice that ravish the land, and you shall give glory to the God of Israel. The Philistines are giving glory to the God of Israel. Israel had misused the ark, seeing it as an object of power, some superstitious, if we just put it out there, then we will have this instant power. And when the ark is taken, they say the glory has departed Israel. And Philistines come and make a sacrifice to the God of Israel, giving glory. Giving glory. When you try to think about this story, I mean, there's so much. I mean, just as a historical account, it is just a fascinating story. I mean, you have this battle, and you have these people bring the ark. You have the other side decide that we just have to fight for our lives. We're going to be slaves tomorrow anyway. Might as well go out in glory almost, and they win. A decisive victory. They take the ark and they put it before their God, and their God bows down to the ark. And then all the plagues occur, and they conclude, we got to get rid of this ark. It is, this God of Israel is really, he's something else. And they start giving glory to him, and they start making sacrifices and offerings to the God of Israel. with hopes that he will relent, that he will let up the judgments on them and the judgments on their gods. And then it comes back to Israel, and Israel still doesn't have it yet. And they open up the ark, and some of them die. But God wasn't ever in the ark. I mean, the Philistines figured it out. It's the God of Israel. You know, the Philistines aren't sitting here going, this ark is powerful. It was the God of Israel that was powerful. And they give glory to him. You know, where do we miss those kind of stories? Where do we somehow shift away and we start thinking that there's power in prayer? And I'm not opposed to that phrase, and I might use that phrase, but we need to be careful when we use a phrase like that. There's power in prayer. There is absolutely no power in prayer. There's power in the God to whom you pray. Now, like I said, I'm not on some crusade to say don't use that phrase, but we should be clear. What are the things that we come to associate that if we do certain things, that entitles us to something? I'm sure I've mentioned before, I'm still after all these years and kind of amazed that Raymond actually did this, but when I was coaching the head basketball coach at this high school I was at, and you know, he was a believer, but he, in non-basketball season, if the weather was really nice, he lived beside the golf course, and he would play golf instead of going to church. But during basketball season, he never missed church. There's this association, you know, you start to make these associations. We start to think that if we do certain things, we can manipulate God. And here's Israel, we're going to manipulate God. We don't know why we lost, but if we bring the ark, we're going to win. And then the glory left. But the defeat wasn't a defeat of God. God was not defeated. Have you ever thought about history? How when things do not work out the way we expect, that we start to conclude that God somehow wasn't really in charge? Because if things didn't work out the way we thought they should, then that surely is an indication God isn't really as powerful as we thought, maybe. But yet, God is so wise and powerful that he is not threatened by some of those defeats that we assume are devastating. And so Israel is defeated. The Philistines capture the ark. God isn't threatened. He just in turn has their God bow down to him. That Israel was defeated wasn't a sign that Yahweh was defeated, because Yahweh can be God anywhere. He is God anywhere. He can, if Israel isn't going to worship him, he can end up with the Philistines, who never really worship him in the sense of embracing him as God, but yet within that pagan society, worship him. They recognize he's more powerful than their God. You know, this story tells us, you know, that God is sovereign. Once again, it clearly demonstrates he is a sovereign God. He's a sovereign God when things don't work out the way we think they ought to work out. He's an irresistible God. He's an all-powerful God. He is the one and only God. Within that setting, they never come to the place where they say, oh, our gods aren't real gods, he's the real God. But what they do within this time frame is they say, he's more powerful than our God. Maybe he will quit beating up our gods. Maybe he will take it easy on our gods. You know, one of the fascinating things in Scripture is that in the Old Testament, there isn't so much an argument that God is the only God and all these others are not really gods, as much as it is presented as he is the superior God. And really, when you get thinking about that, that's a more profound argument. Can you make the argument that he's the only God? And then you're arguing with people that your God didn't really exist. But how much more humiliating is it to say, well, yeah, I understand you got a God, but you see, your God worships my God. Your God bows down to my God. Which, if you start thinking through that, that's saying your God really doesn't exist and he's the only God. But Scripture does it a little differently. And God is to be worshipped. And actually, the Philistines end up having this great military victory, but totally devastated and worshipping, in some sense, the God of Israel. Recognizing that he is a sovereign God. You know, when something happens, there is an appropriate question to ask. Why did God allow this to happen? I don't know that we can always get the answer. And we need to be careful how we search for solutions. For you see, the Israel came up with a solution, and it was a devastating solution. But if their solution had been, Samuel, help us out here. Can you find out what God has to say about this? How different would it have been? And that's where we need to be, the Word of God. We also see in this account that God said something was going to happen, and it happened. He told Eli, your sons will die, they'll die on the same day. Several years later, his sons died, and they died on the same day. God fulfills his word. We also see in this account that God is a God that judges. He judged Eli's sons. Israel was judged. The Philistines were judged. And he still remained the holy, sovereign, all-powerful God. You know, within our society, there's such a movement that God couldn't be a certain way. We start recreating God in our own image, the way we want God to be. So there are many that say, well, there couldn't be a hell. Why couldn't there be hell? Well, because God's not like that. Now, if you had sound biblical reasons for it, that would be one thing. If you say, well, really, the Scripture says there's not going to be any judgment, it's just a myth, well, that would be one thing. But when you start saying, God just can't be that way, it's kind of like Israel saying, well, if we just bring the ark, we're going to win because we have his power before us. Now we have to look at who God is. And God is a God that does judge. In that judgment, it never threatens his holiness because he judges in his holiness. The defeat of certain things do not threaten his sovereignty because he has a plan and he will execute his plan. So in this, we see a sovereign, holy God that is God just the same if Israel is rebellious and goes through some discipline, or if Israel is totally devoted to him and they are victorious. He does not change and he's not threatened by it. Think about us, how threatened we would be if things didn't go right. And we would start to make changes because we would be embarrassed that, you know, our team is losing. They're not playing very well. God's not threatened. It's a great chapter to look at the sovereignty of God. The sovereignty of God. And that when we look at life events, that those life events are no indication that God is not God. His operation in time is vastly different than what we would like it to be at times. And so here it is, Israel concludes. The glory of God has left Israel. And it's the Philistines who bring, in that sense, the glory of God back to Israel. But in reality, God never left. It was wrong theological deductions by everyone. He is God. He alone is God. And he alone is to be worshipped as God. Will you stand with me as we close in prayer? Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for accounts like this that show us how you worked in history. Show us the realism. Sometimes the negative things, sometimes the positive things, but always how it really was. And we see, regardless of the responses of those that should be you totally devoted to you and those that are opposed to you, and whether or not they're consistent, that you're always the same, that you're a holy, sovereign God. Father, help us to not trust in things that represent you, but to truly honor you. And we do pray in Christ's name.